Welcome to Courage Cocktail. I'm your host, Leanne McClymont. Glad you could join us today. Well, in the studios of WCOM in Carver, North Carolina, is the author, Allegra Jordan, who is joining us for an hour's broadcast. She was here before, last fall, if you may recall, when we were talking about the death of the Irish poet Seamus Heaney. Today, we shift the lens back on the written word. Yet this time, it's all about Allegra's work. She has written a book, and the book is called The End of Innocence. It's a beautiful, stunning novel. We're going to be talking about a lot of things about this book, not only the book, but the history, the period of time, the actual process. It's a rich Courage Cocktail today. Now, perhaps while you are listening, I want to set the stage with a little mood food. Take a listen to this song. It's called Over There.
Johnny, get your gun. Take it on the run. Hear them calling you and me, every son of liberty. Hurry right away, no delay, go today. Make your daddy glad to have had such a lad. Tell your sweetheart not to pine, we'll be proud her boy's in line. Over there, send the word over there. That the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming, the drum coming everywhere. So prepare, say a prayer, send the word to beware. We'll be over, we're coming over, and we won't come back till it's over, over there. Johnny, get your gun. Johnny, show the hun, you're a son of a gun. Hoist the flag and let her fly. Yankee Doodle, do or die. Pack your little kit, show your grip, do your bit. Yankees to the ranks, from the towns and the tanks. Make your mother proud of you, and the old red, white, and blue. Over there, send the word over there. That the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming, the drum coming everywhere. So prepare, say a prayer, send the word to beware. We'll be over, we're coming over, and we won't come back till it's over, over there. So prepare, say a prayer, send the word to beware. We'll be over, we're coming over, and we won't come back till it's over, over there.
Welcome to Courage Cocktail. I had to play that for you, Allegra. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. That's a wonderful song. It's so much fun, and it gets everybody kind of in the spirit for a good Labor Day.
Well, you know, I played that song, and I chose that particular song because it became the herald, the much championed song of both World War I and World War II. And there's a ton of little pieces of information in that. And all through the course of today's program, we're going to throw in trivia, listener, so that you actually will get familiar with the 100th birthday, 100th centenary of this amazing period of history for the world. So I set that as mood food. Dear Allegra, tell us about this book.
Oh, thanks, Leanne, for having me and welcoming me to your audience. The novel is about a period, it starts in August, exactly 100 years ago. And during that time, America was really at an innocent place in its history. We weren't necessarily a great world power, but we were doing quite well. And then war broke out in Europe, and America initially wasn't in it. We were hanging out until about 1917. And my novel came about when I realized that there were some communities that actually had Germans and British and Americans in them, and they really struggled 100 years ago with what to do about those competing nationalities, given that some of that a war was breaking out and atrocities were being committed, and anti-German hysteria was starting up in America, in part planted by our British friends in our posts, just the way we hear these days that Russian trolls are planting information about Ukraine in our social media. Well, 100 years ago, we had the British trying to convince us to come into World War I on their side. And so the mood started shifting in August 100 years ago, in part because the war was becoming so big. It became very clear that professional soldiers were not going to be able to finish this war. It was going to become something of an all-country, all-participant war. Eventually, 37 million people were killed or wounded during this time. And it really started about now changing. So I wanted to write a novel about what do you do when you have a community that has people with different perspectives and it starts breaking up. I decided to write a love story. The love interest is German. A count, a very rich man, very powerful man, who suddenly finds himself on the other side of American love, given the anti-German hostility. And his love interest, Helen, is, again, she's someone who we think has it all. She's beautiful. She's privileged. She's in the upper class of Boston. But her mother has just done something very embarrassing. Her mother has decided to speak out on behalf of birth control. And Leanne, you know the Boston climate there. That I don't think they even have sex in Boston at this point in time. Certainly we don't talk about it. And so she, through no fault of her own, her mother embarrasses her, and she gets jilted by a boyfriend, and she feels like she's gone from on top of the world to the very bottom of the world. And when we're on the bottom of the world, we're vulnerable in a way that we're not at other points in our lives. And so this vulnerable German man and this vulnerable Boston bombing woman find each other and have to piece together what does it mean to rebuild a world that that has been very cruel of late.
I'm sitting here. This is an amazing encapsulation. I have had the privilege of reading this book, I need people to know that up front. And I may be leading the guest here, but it's because this is such an extraordinary tale. Let's talk about that particular community. Tell us, you mentioned, yes, this is a particular community. It sure is. And even for our people here in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, the bottom line is all communities function like this, but there are some remarkable aspects to this particular community. Will you tell us about it?
Well, I'm a Southerner, and Southerners, when we write novels, tend to write novels of place. Mm-hmm. And I was mesmerized by this poem that was written and circulated about 100 years ago about Boston. And it goes like this, and our listeners may be well familiar with it. And this is old Boston, home of the bean and the cod, where the Lowells talk to the Cabots, and the Cabots talk only to God. And that really has stuck in, because in part it was true. It's a very close society made up of families that had a lot going for them. The families were often wealthy, very interested in public service, very interested in the character of the community. But as we see, it's a pretty close table. I mean, the table that they celebrate is only for two, and 50% of the people at that table are having to sit in silence. the Lowells don't get any conversation. And this is it's a very closed society, very tight one, where clearly intimacy is not one of the highest values. And so when you live in that society that is built on prestige and built on a great deal of public service, these are people that we owe a lot as a country to, because they really did help form our character and did contribute their time, talent, and treasure to building not only Boston, but a greater world through positive and affirming ideas put throughout a number of different communities. But when you're working in that kind of community where there's very little intimacy, when you find intimacy, you want to keep it. You want to grab it with both hands and say, someone sees me and they love me. And they treat me as a human, not as a competitive family there, you know, who only is here to build character in society. And so it's an incredible group of people, but it's also one where there's a great starvation for human touch and connection. That's not something that's necessarily valued in that community. So, of course, if you're a 17-year-old girl on the brink of, on the brink of life, yeah, that's going to be a hard place. If this is how they treat their friends, how will they treat their enemies? It's a good question.
Outsiders, for that matter. Well, chili and ramen, and certainly it is in a very oriented, puritanical, rooted sense. And I speak this as a fifth generation person from Boston, from that region, I should say. But I wanted to ask you, tell us, why did you set this on a college campus, and which college campus does this romance begin?
Ah, well, it's all about Harvard at this point. And Harvard is an interesting place within Boston because it's a place that yes, there are classes there, but it's basically a meritocracy. You get in there based on some gifted aspect of your personality. And once you're brought into this community, you're given opportunities as based on your merit. And so that's a positive aspect of that culture. Why I particularly chose this place for the novel was based on a war memorial that I saw there that just absolutely shocked me. And I grew up in Alabama. My dad is from Mississippi. My mom's from Ohio. And I had seen a lot of war memorials in my life, both in Ohio and in the Deep South. And I thought I knew what those war memorials were like. They have, these are our people. We honor our people. Maybe they fought for a good cause. Maybe they fought for a bad cause. But they're our people, and we're just going to honor them. And they usually never have the other side mentioned. It's just really kind of about our team. And I went to Harvard, and I saw a memorial there that just shocked me, and it showed me that the way I had been thinking about things wasn't the way it had to be. They had a memorial in Harvard Yard in the Memorial Church to the Germans who had fought for the Kaiser in World War I. And that surprised me because I just didn't think that people did that. And here's a closed society that is rooted, as you mentioned, in kind of puritanical justice. In their DNA, it is not about mercy and compassion. It's about there's right and wrong, and and we know what's right, and we're going to celebrate what's right. And we might just not mention what's wrong. That's okay. It's okay to say we're for these things. But here they had a greater vision of what it took to restore a community, in that they said, okay, we know that the Germans during World War I fought against Americans and British and French, and they have a room for the 393 Harvard students and officers who died on those sides, on the side of the Allies. But here they said, you know what, we want to put up a plaque to remember our German students because we want to have a greater vision about what society can be like. We want to give people a place. If they stop their violence, they can't continue bad behavior, but if they stop their violence, that you can come back and we can restore our community based on our common humanity. And that, to me, blew me away. It was a moment of grace that is very rare anywhere in the world. It's something that that I hadn't grown up with, and I wanted to celebrate that. And that's at Harvard is particularly surprising to me because that's not necessarily a place that I would ever think to go for a place of grace or a place of mercy or a place of generosity. It's not really that's not the Harvard culture. And so this is a light that stands even brighter in that darkness, and I wanted to celebrate it.
It's almost as if that war memorial pierced history.
Absolutely. It pierced my heart.
Oh.
It pierced the idea that we can only have justice in this world. Because honestly, we need justice. We need a lot of justice in the world. And I'm certainly someone who says there is right and there is wrong. And if you're behaving badly, you can't stay because it will damage the community. I believe that. But I also believe if someone says, okay, I'm ready to change, how are we going to get them back if we don't offer some path forward? Do we always have to have this generational guilt? Or can we in some way move forward on an equal footing?
So many times in our work here on the radio show, in Sipping Courage Cocktail, the sidebar is disruption. It's the idea that maybe what is working is failing to work, and it's time to try something new. And I listened to this, and it must have been an extraordinary amount of resistance to put up that plaque. Do you know the background story? Was it done 100 years or 50 years, or was it done shortly thereafter the war drew to a close?
Well, that's a really great point. And it's one of the things I love about the plaque. Because so to describe it for the listener, we have a church, and on one side you have clearly something that was very well planned. It's a memorial to the Allies, and it's very beautiful. It's with travertine marbles and gilded letters. And then across the church in a kind of shady corner is this plaque, and it's putting up, it's in a different material. It's in bronze, and many people can go into the church without ever noticing it's there. And so what I love about this is it was such a patchwork. Mm-hmm. It was not something that was easy to do. Clearly there was a fight. It was not something that everybody agreed on. I mean, obviously, why would you write something in Latin? Not even at Harvard, nobody can read Latin. You know, it's something that it's like.
I learned my Greek there, young lady. So.
Okay, gotcha.
But they read Greek very well.
That's okay. Right. If it were Greek, maybe. But you know, it was clearly the result of a fight, and uh-huh. I like it so much better than. There's another university, Yale, which I did not know about this, but at Yale they list for the Civil War everybody who was a student at Yale. They just put. You know, here are all these people, and then we're going to write after their names who they fought for. And that's a very rare occurrence. Harvard didn't do that for its Civil War people. But in the World War I people, you could just see that they were fighting. This was not an easy decision. And if we think about the conversations we might have in our own families, if, say, someone runs off and does something bad that hurts everybody, that might waste some money or really hurts people's feelings or even causes real violence. When the family gets together and say, okay, what's the right way to move forward, that's not going to be an easy conversation. We will have discussions about, you know, what is right, and then what is unmerited favor, which is called grace. And you know, that's a really, it's a judgment call. And so anyway, to answer your question, the memorial was put up, the memorial church was built in 1932, long after World War I was finished. And the German memorial was put up shortly after the church was built. So not a lot of time had lapsed, but you could clearly tell there was a deep conversation, and there's a reason why it's in Latin. But I think that makes it even better because it's more realistic. It's just not a pretty conversation when we have these justice versus mercy conversations, and we shouldn't pretend that. We should really honor that these are tough choices that people are making.
But they did it, and that's what counts. So may I beg you, before we go into this little break, can you read for us? This will be Allegra Jordan reading from her new book, which will be released August 26th. We've got her in the studio pre-release, and I'm going to ask her to read. You might need to cue us up on what section.
Well, how about if I start at the beginning? And the beginning, I'll read just the first three paragraphs of the book about Harvard itself. And this is to locate you in the place of Harvard and the attitude that they have, a very closed culture that, you know, it's very much based on I'm right, you're wrong. So chapter one, Harvard Yard, Wednesday, August 26th, 1914. It was said that heroic architects didn't fare well in Harvard Yard. If you wanted high fashion, move past the Johnston Gate, preferably to New York. The yard was Boston's, energetic, spare, solid. The yard had evolved as a collection of buildings, each with its own oddities, interspersed among large elm trees and tracts of grass. The rich red brickwork of Seaver Hall stood apart from the austere gray of University Hall. Appleton Chapel's Romanesque curves differed from the gabled turrets of Weld and the sharp peaks of Matthews. Holworthy, Hollis, and Stoughton were as plain as the Pilgrims. Holden Chapel, decorated with white cherubs above its door and tucked into a corner of the yard, looked like a young girl's playhouse. The red walls of Harvard and Massachusetts halls, many agreed, could be honest, but not much more. The massive new library had been named for a young man who went down on the Titanic 2 years before. there were those who would have had the architect trade tickets with the young lad. At least the squat form dower roofline and grate of Corinthian columns did indeed look like a library. The yard had become not a single building demanding the attention of all around it, but the sum of its parts, its many irregular halls filled with many irregular people. Taken together over the course of nearly 300 years, this endeavor of the Puritans was judged to be a resounding success by most. In fact, none were inclined to think higher of it than those forced to leave Harvard, such as the bespectacled Wilhelm von Lützow Brandl, a senior and the only son of a Prussian countess, at that hour suddenly called to return to Germany.
And so the lead character emerges beautiful. I love how you wrote as plain as the pilgrims. You've nailed it. Now, you clearly, just for our listeners' benefit, you spent some time at Harvard doing your graduate degree.
Right. I did 2 years in an MBA program at Harvard Business School. And before that, I spent 2 years on campus as a research associate for professors there.
So you came in as an employee and left as a graduate.
That's right.
That's quite an important trajectory.
It's very nice. I like it when universities pay me as opposed to me paying them.
God bless you for saying that. All right. Now we kind of got off topic here. I want to learn more about this young, dashing young German Prussian aristocrat. Tell me about Wilhelm.
So Wilhelm is a product of a mixed marriage. So his father is the Southern German. They're Catholic down there. They're much more about the heart. And his mother is this Northern Prussian countess. And up there, they're Protestant and very rules-oriented, we should say. And at that point, the Prussian class was part of the Kaiser's war machine. And the Bavarians down south were, people who, look at Oktoberfest. You can kind of imagine. And so Wilhelm's, his parents have him. His father's a great poet in Germany. His father dies, and he's now the only son and only relative of his mother. He's starting a senior year. He loves writing poetry. He thinks he's going to have this nice life after school. And his mother starts sending him telegrams. You have to come home in Boston. They're going crazy. There's a lot of anti-German activity. And Wills is just blowing her off, as many teenagers blow off their parents.
I'm glad to hear that happen 100 years ago.
Yeah. That's right.
Never got the telegram. Oh, is that like never got the text? Okay.
That's right. And so she is hearing things. In Germany, things are sounding worse than they are. But Wills suddenly learns that one of his friends, who's also German, who had known for a long time in Germany, has just been found dead in his room.
At Harvard.
And we don't know if it's a suicide, and there are some reasons to suggest it might be, or if it was murder based on the anti-German sentiment that is breaking out. In this point, it pays to know a little bit of the historical context, because when I mentioned those British reports were coming out, that had really serious consequences. At this time, we don't hear a lot about the internment of German aliens, much like we hear about the internment of Japanese aliens during World War II. But 250,000 German citizens in America, German Americans, were forced to register during this time. The person in charge in Washington of the enemy registration, of course, they didn't become enemies until America entered the war a couple years later. But the person in charge was J. Edgar Hoover. He was 23 years old. And he was put in charge of registering anybody who looked like an alien, a German alien. One of the people in this, who I kind of fell in love with, was the Boston Symphony conductor, who was Swiss, named Karl Muck. And he had been born in Germany, but was actually Swiss. And he was one of the people targeted for internment. And he was just brutally treated. His reputation was tarnished. All sorts of horrible things were said about him. And here we have one of the greatest conductors and most innovative conductors in the world at that time, certainly a leading light for the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And he was taken out of his job and put in a prison camp in northern Georgia. It was a real travesty that happened. But these things were very real, and even though we don't know about it now, what people were going through, if they were Germans at that time, was really quite awful.
When I listen to you describe the characters and listen to the language of you've chosen for this beautiful book, I keep on hearing the word synthesis. This is such a beautiful synthesis of the history of what was going on. So much of it resonates now within our hearts and what's going on all over the world. And I can't help but think about, you know, the whole aspect of the beautiful young woman who makes up the other part of this love story. So we need to introduce her as well. Can you find us a little piece that may describe her?
Ah, here we go. When we bring up Helen, what we do is we switch from Harvard University to a dance in Concord, Massachusetts.
And Concord is about, 15 miles west of Boston?
About. And it is as beautiful a little city as you can get. It's where Emerson and Thoreau, it's by Walden Pond. It's just this very quaint, gorgeous place. Louisa May Alcott's house is there. And so it's a place with deep literary roots. But in the novel that I have, it's a place where in this Boston society where you're never enough, even the Lowells are being ignored by the Cabots. The people in Concord are there, and they're giving a dance. And in part, they're giving a dance because their neighbors force them to give a dance, because they're told, you know, you might be very rich, but you're not good enough, so you need to do the following things for the city of Boston. And so the richest people, you know, outside of town in Concord are being essentially bullied by their friends, told if you want to have social status, you'll give a dance. And at this dance, where, you know, this beautiful estate worthy of a John Singer Sargent painting, we're going to have a dance, and Helen shows up there, Helen Winship Brooks. And here's the discussion of how she comes to be in the book. The dance that night was an elegant affair. Japanese lanterns glowed a mellow orange all along the driveway to the mansion. Servants assembled trays of delicacies on the closely cropped grounds by the kitchen. Smoke from spits roasting lamb and beef drifted lazily in the air. Boys cranked ice cream machines under bunting hung windows. Young women in white pinafores carried silver trays stacked with pastries into the house. Children ran across the lawn in a pack, carrying sparklers toward the white lattice gazebo, which stood at the edge of the Concord River. In spite of their misgivings, all of Boston's top society had turned out this evening for such a party, crowding the receiving line by the time 17-year-old Helen Winship Brooks and her parents reached their host. Helen was a slender girl with pretty smile, large blue eyes, and a sharp tongue. Boston attributed her spirited opinions to her mother's side, which had produced generations of unflinchingly frank women who seemed to live forever. Her charm and steadfastness were attributed to her father's family, which had produced generations of men bred to withstand the onslaught of Winship-like women. Brooks' men tended only to live into their early 60s.
We're laughing here. Sorry, interruption.
Okay. On that cool August evening, Helen stood prettily by both of her parents in the receiving line at the Darlington mansion. Like most of the unmarried girls there, she wore a simple dress of white silk. Her adornment was a matching white silk purse and a white satin ribbon wrapped around her dark hair, worn tonight in a severe knot. Mr. Brooks insisted that Boston encouraged and improved of this temperate style. She thought it made her look like George Washington, and that Boston approved because Boston didn't change, not even for war.
Beautiful. We're getting the picture. Oh, you nailed the characters. You totally did. The bucolic families of that region. It's a beautiful countryside setting, extremely, extremely historical, rich in history. But you've nailed the dominant matriarchal world of that Brahmin set. And I'm so grateful that you were able to explain that and receive that?
Oh, it's so much fun to live on this side of satire and farce with that society, you know.
I mean, they're dead now.
Yeah. I'm about to go up to Boston, and I'm going to have to maybe tone it down a little bit.
Don't you love the South?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But it's really fun because it really gives itself to satire, mm-hmm. And it's certainly worthy of a few little pokes.
A little poke. Well, now we hear the sharp tongue. I dare say the sharp pen. So, as you know, we always have a lovely little break in between the midst of Courage Cocktail to allow our listeners to go out and grab themselves some drink, a long drink of cold iced tea or sweet tea. And when we return, Allegra, get your thinking cap on. We are going to play a trivia game.
Can't wait.
I can't either. Thank you.
WCOM, your all-volunteer community radio station in Carrboro, needs your support. Do you have an idea for a radio show? How about an interest in engineering or a computer background? Are you interested in fundraising or just meeting a group of wonderful people? Please consider a donation of time or money to support this gem of the community. To find out more, please visit our website, wcomfm.org. To make a financial contribution, sponsor your favorite show, or help support our many featured news and information programs, click on the PayPal donate button at the top of our main page. Again, please visit our website, wcomfm.org, and thanks for your support.
And welcome back to Courage Cocktail Radio Show. I'm your host, Leanne McClymont. Thanks for listening. You are tuned in to the community radio station WCOM LPFM 103.5 from Carrboro, North Carolina. We are broadcasting live from the heart of the Art Center here in Carrboro. I want to take this moment to thank our sponsors and underwriters. We have a gratitude we owe to AuthorsBoutique.com, www.AuthorsBoutique.com, where you can learn all things about publishing. And also, we want to thank our underwriter, Videri Chocolate. They can be found at www.viderichocolatefactory.com. In case you're just joining us for your lunch, we are hosting the author, Allegra Jordan, who is here speaking to us, introducing us to her new book, The End of Innocence. Now, we've been building some context for the book with some music. And I wanted to kick off, before we even go back into the book, to talk a little bit about trivia. Now, I've got you here, and you're stuck. You're going to have to get the answer right before we move on to this conversation.
Oh, no.
All right, here it is. The question is, I've noticed that whenever I've been looking into the World War I history online and even materials, I see the image of a red poppy. What is that all about, Allegra?
The red poppy is a beautiful symbol of remembrance from World War I, but it's now a symbol of remembrance for almost any type of soldier. And the origin of the poppy came from the churned up battlefields of the Western Front. These fields were terribly beaten up. The beautiful houses and fields that used to be there were no more. This happened primarily in the fall and winter of 1914. In the spring of 1915, people were shocked to see red poppies on these fields that were truly blood-drenched, awful places to be. And so it was surprising and hopeful that in this devastation we actually saw flowers. And it was a symbol of renewal, a symbol of remembrance that these poppies came from that horrible background or those fields.
And lest we forget, this story is about war. And there are extraordinary scenes, grotesque truth. It's feels like the book bleeds in certain parts. And I wanted to ask you, we're going to cue up a beautiful segment, an excerpt from your publisher, Random House, has set this up. But could you just tell us a little bit about what we're about to hear?
The audiobook has a wonderful actor, Kirby Hayburn, who is reading it. And what we'll hear is from the prologue of the book, which describes our German Wills on the Western Front. And remember, he's a poet, and he suddenly finds himself in war. And it's just beyond his devastation about how he could be there, given his world was just a beautiful world, and now suddenly he's in the middle of the Western Front in World War I.
The broken men lay where they fell, their bodies strewn in the fields of southern Belgium. In White Shot and Hollebeke, Gayluvelt and Polygon Wood, Messines and Menon, the German soldiers interred the dead they could drag behind their firing lines during the waning days of battle. But in late November, after a massive month-long assault gave no rational hope of victory, commanders ordered the recovery of the dead to stop. Moving live men into no man's land was suicide. Rescue and burial, out of the question. Instead, nature absolved the field of its bitter crop in one sloppy storm. Rain soaked the ground and churned a viscous mud. The mud dislodged sandbagged walls, snapped telegraph wires, sucked off boots, and swallowed the bodies mired in the sodden terrain. As the rain turned to snow, the north wind scattered it across the graveyard, creating a new, uneven field. It was an imperfect burial. During the early dawn hours of December 1st, a young German Signal Corps soldier stood at the corner of two adjoining trenches. His short blonde hair was uncovered. His helmet, the heavy and ornate cover of the Uhlans, rested on the ground. The rain had soaked through his gray overcoat and dampened his tall leather boots. His thin nose dripped constantly, irritated by the smell of wet wool. Lieutenant Wilhelm von Lutzow-Brandl, 21, held a wire and a transmitter, but he had stopped working with them. Instead, he stood transfixed, looking over the wooden parapet at the snow blanketing the field.
All gone, he thought. Builders, farmers, teachers, students. Is this how we end? Jumbled parts in a mass grave? Swept under a clean white carpet?
The wind bit into his neck. It burned his bruised ear, and the quick falling snow piled around his boots. But the question repeated ceaselessly in his mind, like a record's needle turning after the song is through, the machine's energy not yet spent. It seemed like such a short time ago, when one single death had brought his world to a halt. Mere months before, He'd been a student in America, at Harvard, when Max von Steiger, a fellow German classmate and childhood friend, had died. His death set into motion an unstoppable chain of events that had torn apart Harvard's campus. Now, on the front lines of war, there were too many dead to mourn just one.
And so, the beautiful reading of this excerpt, and I have to say, this is why I set up the poppy, because the fields were so torn, the mud, everything. And the thing about a poppy is that the dormant seeds, they can remain and lie dormant for decades until the soil is lifted. So help us. This is a moving passage and a painful one.
The idea of loss is very real. And we all feel it in our lives. It's a, you know, every human will go through some type of loss. Whether or not it's a physical loss of health or a friend or your identity, you know, some emotional loss, you'll feel it. And what I wanted to explore is, what then? Sometimes we find cultures that are really just stuck. They can't get out of this awful, awful place. It was so bad and so awful, you just can't get out of it. And we feel that way about the Middle East. We feel that way about some places in Iraq. We feel Afghanistan, we Northern Ireland. I mean, we just say, you know, is that the way it has to be forever?
Missouri.
Yes, Missouri, right. And another night, another shooting. What is going on here? Is this the way of the world? And one of the parts of the book that I wanted to get out pretty early on was the idea of the poppy, the idea of what a professor says pretty early on is that, you know, there is loss, but there's also renewal. And the renewal is going to be different than the loss. Things will be different, but there is renewal. And that's a very hopeful thought. And if we forget about that, then we'll give way to despair and cynicism and depression. But if we can keep that in mind, then we can just take the next step and make the next decision a good decision to create a hopeful community. Maybe we're not there yet, but at least we see signs of hope, and we can walk along those with those signs of hope to a better future together.
So, Allegra, I hear you as a master storyteller, but I also hear this, what you framed here is what I classify now as a restorative narrative. And it's all about acknowledging difficult issues, difficult loss, but then building a way out. I keep on seeing this image, just getting out. What is the next step? And so much of what's occurring actually in media now, of course, is asking the next question. And how do we go forward? Okay, we understand what our problems are. What is it that's working, and how can we make that work for us? So this is, I think your novel is so timely, and you're understanding, the fancy word is exegesis. Is this right? When we start talking about a passage and trying to understand all of what's tucked inside there.
I think that's your Greek roots. Ah! If I had only taken Greek, I wouldn't know that word.
Well, you know, I have to tell you.
I think that's, it sounds
right. Sounds
right? Yeah, it sounds right. And,
but the point I'm trying to get at is, you know, you've unbundled so many messages and unpacking so many themes here. It's not just a love story. It's not just a remarkable, and I say truthful and respectful, bow to Harvard. Because this is one thing that they did. They did acknowledge the brotherhood of the mind. And this book, and there are other wonderful, delightful, much more upbeat characters in the story. Before we run out of time, you've got to tell us and our listener a little bit about that wonderful teaching English, writing English composition character.
Right, absolutely. There's a professor named Charles Copeland. And one thing when you're writing a story that about war, you need to acknowledge we can't just have a story about war. We need to laugh. We need to love. We need to have a number of different emotions, or people will just put it down. It's a little too heavy, you know. So we try to keep it light. And one of the great comedians and also heroes, moral compasses of the book, is a professor, Charles Copeland. And 100 years ago, some of the biggest celebrities before the age of radio or television, certainly, were English greater, freshman English essay graders. And these people became celebrities because generation after generation, they helped young people who came into college write better, form their character better, just by the act of sitting down and working with the incoming student on their essay. And one of the most famous ones was this guy, Charles Copeland.
So he truly existed, Professor Copeland, or grader. Is that his name?
That was his duty. He was a grader of freshman essays. But he also liked doing some public readings. And so he gained a following by doing these public readings. And he became such a beloved figure because he actually spent time with students. Imagine that, you know, in a busy university life, spending time with your students, that when he decided to go down to New York, from Boston to New York, again, remember, no big title at Harvard, Theodore Roosevelt would come to his readings. J.P. Morgan would stop work and come to his readings. Max Perkins, who was Thomas Wolfe, Ernest Hemingway, and F. Scott Fitzgerald's editor, would come to his readings.
I see. The man had some influence.
He had some influence in part because he really cared about people. And so here, but when he cared about people, it was in the way that only Harvard could do. You could never know that he cared about you. And so he would take jabs at you. He would kind of kick you when you were down. He would make you feel like, you know, he would make fun of you. But then he would come back and he would say just the right thing at the right moment. And he's the one who gets the line in the book that says, I have it here in a very early page. His students are leaving for war, and he says, he's lecturing to his students, and he knows that some of them will be leaving that afternoon for war. And he says, here's the passage. Copeland's face, stern for the past hour of lecturing, softened. He cleared his throat. As we have heard before and will hear again, there is loss in this world, and we shall feel it, if not today, then tomorrow or the week after that. That is the way of things. But there is also something equal to loss that you must not forget. There is an irrepressible renewal of life that we can no more stop than blot out the sun. This is a good and encouraging thought. Write me if you go to war and tell me what you see. That's all for today. And with that, the class was dismissed.
Oh, write me.
One of Copeland's, when you look in the archives at Harvard, you know, if you ever need to go down to those dusty rooms, there's a huge number of boxes of letters that students wrote Copeland from the war front. And these are from John Reed. These are from, that's the most famous one. But they're from a number of different students of all ranks who took it kindly. And Copeland would write back that they would write their teacher and say, this is what's happening. And it was, you know, it was terrible. But these very lonely boys had this friend back at Harvard who knew them, who cared about them enough to correct their grammar. And they would keep that connection with them. And it was his most prized possession. Were these letters from World War I. It was just lovely to get to sit back and experience this intimacy between professor and student during that time.
And you know, this book that you've written may be so well received among so many of us, but I think that the young people, our next generation, must read this book. Kids my daughter's age, because I see in the story this importance of learning from our mistakes, but knowing, listen, their times are tough, things don't go as expected, but you cannot turn into cynics, which is what your book does.
Oh, thank you. I hope that it was that it will speak to students who, you know, who want, it's not for everyone, I understand that, but for those people who are open to this very beautiful community, this very beautiful situation that elevates character, and you know, and people are interested in that. There's also a great love story. You know, it's fun, but also I want to make something lovely so people would open their hearts to the idea of, okay, maybe life can be better. Let me not give up. Let me not fall into depression. Even if my whole community is depressed, I can see in the world somewhere out there, there's a place where they might do it differently, and that might create a healthier place. And so that was part of the package in reading the book.
And thus it leads us into this whole, really, the counterpoint of Reconciliation Poetry Project that brought you here to the first time. The word reconciliation really is the story of your life. We are having to ask you a simple question. How did you write this book?
It's so easy.
Why did you write this book?
Well, I grew up in a world that had a lot of issues from Vietnam. My dad was in Vietnam and suffered post-traumatic stress disorder. I grew up in Selma, Alabama. After I had been in a military family, we ended up there. And I had seen, you know, the division in community, and had really wanted my father to be able to reconcile with what had happened at this terrible time in American history, my community to be able to reconcile. And a lot of times it wasn't happening. And so I had thought, well, maybe that's just the way the world is. And then I found out, no, it can be different. And it was just so helpful and joyful that I thought, I really want to share that story. So the question was, how did I come to write the book? I had the idea and I wanted people to love the idea as much as I did. So I spent about 21 years researching, thinking about it, writing it, sharing drafts with people to make it just the best I could so that people would laugh, they'd cry, they'd be entertained, and they'd also get a little dollop of, hey, maybe the world can be different.
And that is already, listeners, this has been so well received. You've had countless numbers of positive reviews, people from all over, Yale, the world at Yale, saying something nice about Harvard. I had to take a second look there.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's just such a privilege that you have done this, that you've joined us. You're working on something else, though. I know you've got a couple of tricks up your sleeve. Are you allowed to talk about them?
I am. I love it, especially this time of year. My next book is about the highest, holiest season in the South, football. So it's set in 1979 during the time that Bear Bryant had what's considered the best football team ever in college level. The 1979 Alabama, it's set 1979 Alabama during their second run for a national championship. Mm. It's set in rural Alabama, and it's a place where sports are religion, and religion is a sport. Everything is drenched in the language of the gospel, but it's parched for grace. There is not any grace there to find. and so I'm having a real fun time. I'm doing a lot of research on tailgating and a culture of just kind of what's legal and illegal in this culture. So it's just been a great, great fun. I'm writing it now, about 40% of the way done.
Oh, I'm so excited. We're so excited to have that coming along in the pipeline. I'm so grateful that you have been joining us today. How do people learn more about you, your work, what's going on, where you will be, where are you going to have your readings?
Oh, thank you so much, Leon. They can go to my website, allegrajordan.com. That's allegrajordan.com. And there's information about where I'm going. Next week I'll be in Boston. I get to launch at a party at Harvard.
And I think you said it was going to happen on August 26th.
It is August 26th.
Surprise, surprise.
Yes, I'm going to get to read the opening paragraph of my book, which starts August 26th, 100 years ago at Harvard. And that's going to be a great joy. And from there I go to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution Decatur Book Festival in Atlanta, outside of Atlanta. And I'll have a reading there, which that's going to be one of the top regional independent book. I think it might be the largest independent book festival in the United States now. Oh, so I'll go there. But there's some information on my website about where I'm going. And also they can tune in to Courage Cocktail. I believe that you have excerpts from former shows there. And I certainly will share with people this
That's
excerpt.
Lovely. Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for everything that you're doing. I want you to stay on track. I think that Professor Copeland is alive and well inside that little left-handed Allegra Jordan.
Thanks. He's a neat guy.
He's an effective man for certain. And I want to thank you for joining us today. You know, we try to wrap up our show as at the close of the hour. We have a few things happening here in WCOM. We are celebrating our own little anniversary. We have been here 10 years. This is the 10th anniversary of WCOM. And there are all kinds of events being planned. Low-key events, some kind of little bit more fun events. Dates haven't been nailed down. But I encourage all of you, particularly the listeners who are local, that's in the state of North Carolina, in the Piedmont, come on out over to www.wcom.org. wcomfm.org, and you're going to start getting a cue, a little feed of what's happening, because community radio is at an all-time high for this Carrboro region. The radio station is certainly, we host 60 guests during the coast of the host and shows during the course of a week. I had the privilege of talking about the radio station yesterday. I was invited to speak at the Kiwanis organization here in Hillsborough, North Carolina. It was a privilege to be there and to talk about our work, but it also reminded me of how important it is for you, whether you are in North Carolina, nearby, or somewhere else. If there is a local community radio station, take a closer look. With some great materials happening here, great minds, really a wonderful opportunity to consider that there is a sensibility to what local farm to table has done for our food. We have the same process rippling out, local people talking about their local communities, reporting about them, investigating them. I really want you to consider how blessed we are to have these opportunities. And if you have one close by, poke around and look around. Meanwhile, always welcome to support WCOM FMLP. And I want to thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure to be with you. I'll be here next week. You bring the lunch and I'll bring the courage cocktail. Thanks for listening.